Hello, this is Byron Richards, and you are tuned in to my weekly Wellness Update podcast, bringing you the health news that you can use. And of course, this week will be no exception. Starting out in my never-ending battle to convince you that you should get out and do some aerobic exercise is a study, Aerobics Stimulates New Blood Cell Formation. Now, your blood cells, your immune cells, or your white blood cells, as well as your red blood cells, are born in that power plant within your body called your bones. Your bones are not just a skeleton, you know, a little skeleton hanging in the closet here coming up into Halloween time. They are actually functional and dynamic units of physical structure that are absolutely vital for their metabolic activity within those bones. And, of course, your red blood cells, your white blood cells in a constant state of turnover. In other words, they get out in your body, they get used, they have to be recycled and rejuvenated by being made new again. So your red blood cells, new every 6 weeks. Anyway, the long and the short of it is that if you don't use it, you will lose it. And so it appears that aerobics is a powerful stimulator of new blood cell formation. Now, your blood cells, or the stem cells within your bones, can become different things. They don't have to become blood cells. In fact, they can become fat. Yeah, that's right. You can just fill up your bone with fat to a greater or lesser extent. But the more fat you have in the bone, the less new red or white blood cells you have, and thus the less fit your system is. Not good. No value in being a couch potato, none whatsoever. Get out there, use your body. Your body likes to be used. It turns on genes and do all kinds of things that are good for you. There is no shortcut to being healthy, and exercise needs to be a consistent part of your program. And I know there are many of you jogging while you're listening to this podcast, and those of you who are, congratulations. Those of you who are stuck driving in a car listening to this, I hope you're planning to exercise later. All right, now, friendly flora prevent intestinal damage caused by antacids and painkillers. Yes, a nasty combination. You know, Americans are famous for quick fixes and symptom suppression. So if you have heartburn, you know, you like to get out that antacid of one form or another. In this case, we're talking about the actual heavy-duty ones, the proton pump inhibitors. And you combine it with some sort of a pain-killing medication, a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug, very often used together, by the way. And a new study shows that the combination induces bacterial imbalance in the small intestine that can actually injure the small intestine, damage the tissue. So you have the you have these drugs that reduce, you know, a certain kind of inflammation, but they also reduce, I mean, they reduce COX-2, which is cyclooxygenase 2, the inflammatory side of the coin, but they also reduce COX-1, which is the signaling system that generates new epithelial cells in the intestinal tract that protect the barrier of the intestinal tract from the contents within it. And then you take a acid-suppressing medication which causes bacterial and fungal overgrowth in the stomach and also in the small intestine. You end up with small intestine injury because you're both creating bad environment and you're inhibiting the body's ability to generate cells that protect itself. Well, this is now proven, not surprisingly. It had to get proven sooner or later by somebody. It's obviously happening and has been for decades. It appears, thankfully, that friendly flora may be able to prevent the damage, and at least in the short term, but anyone stuck on these things long term has got some real problems. I mean, obviously, pain is a real problem anyway, and acid in antacids are a problem. So, but my point is, it's not a good combination, and you should be on your friendly flora minimally and other digestive healers to protect the damage that is probably occurring in the small intestine from the use of these medications, especially if they're being taken daily on an ongoing basis. All right, new insights on how stress causes acid indigestion. Just when I thought I knew everything, ha ha, something else comes along that interests and fascinates me. Of course, that's why I write these articles. It's quite fascinating for me. I hope you guys find it interesting, guys and gals. find it interesting because I do. And you know, I mean, I've been studying this stuff for 30 years, and I find the new science, which puts new twists on things, to be interesting, to say the least. Of course, I'm kind of a nutrition geek, so, you know, what I find interesting may or may not be interesting to you, but I, you know, I guess most of you who are listening to this must find it interesting. Anyway, enough of that. So, we have bile acid indigestion, which, you know, most of acid indigestion is, especially when it's chronic. I mean, you can just have, you know, alkaline and acid components in food that aren't, you don't have the digestive power, and they're interacting with each other, making gas. You can be feeding some bacteria with too much sugar or something. I mean, you know, there's all these simple things. I mean, it's just basic, simple stress can cause indigestion by removing the blood supply to your stomach, or reducing it so it's not warm in there, it's cold. I mean, no animal eats when it's stressed except humans, and of course you're not going to digest food well under those circumstances. But when we start getting into ongoing acid indigestion, as it's called, most of the time it's actually bile acid indigestion, meaning it's not the hydrochloric acid in the stomach, but rather the bile acids in the small intestine are moving back into the stomach, causing the symptoms of acid indigestion, although it's actually bile acids, not stomach acids. This is being proved more and more, and is something I've observed for many, many years, especially with chronic indigestion. Now, the interesting new twist on this is that cortisol, the stress hormone, is a big, big player in this. Not because it's stressing out, you know, cortisol is like oil in a car engine. So it's not actually the cortisol that makes your stomach or digestion system tighten up when you feel stressed. That's adrenaline or adrenaline-like byproducts. Cortisol is actually the lubricant. It's trying to buffer the stress. It's like, as I like to say, it's like oil in your car engine. If you're pushing your body and you don't have enough cortisol, you kind of burn up. And of course, those who push their bodies too hard and don't get enough sleep and do all kinds of other things, their cortisol levels elevate simply because their body is trying to cool it off. Anti-inflammation. Cortisol is actually an anti-inflammatory hormone. That's why doctors give, say, prednisone, which is a cortisol-like drug, to knock down inflammation that's serious. But that's not what I'm talking about here. I am talking about cortisol and its role in what is called bile acid recycling. And so this is a new study, and it shows for the very first time that cortisol controls the recycling of bile acids. Well, what is this all about? I mean, this is kind of interesting to me. So it actually turns out that cortisol helps prepare your body to digest food. So when you get hungry, your body starts to make cortisol. This is not a stress response. It's another function of cortisol. Our bodies use the same hormone for multiple things. Our bodies have a very interesting system of economy. I mean, they don't just have nice, neat little roles for one hormone for one thing. They have this elegant system of using something for multiple things. So cortisol in this situation communicates to your liver, telling your liver to fill up your gallbladder with bile. It's actually the cortisol being released when you're hungry that's telling your liver to fill your gallbladder with bile so that you can get ready to digest fats that will be coming in the upcoming meal. And then when you eat, the bile is released into your small intestine, of course, which it, you know, emulsifies the fats, breaks them into little droplets so that you can absorb them better. Okay, and then when the bile gets to the end of your small intestine, the bile salts are extracted out of the bile and sent back to your liver to be used again. And this is what we mean by bile acid recycling. It's a normal process in your body. Now, of course, if you can sequester some of that bile, you can also soak up some of your cholesterol, because the cholesterol is in the bile. So that's why if you have a higher fiber intake, you'll actually clear out some cholesterol. And then you're still going to recycle the bile, but there'll be less of it, and your body will have to synthesize it anew. Which, you know, it's kind of a workout for your liver, but it can do it, and it's actually a good way to help clear things out. Okay, but that's not exactly what I'm talking about here. I'm just kind of adding that in because you've heard of these things, obviously, or maybe not obviously, but, you know, these things are issues relating to bile in your digestive tract. Anyway, we have this situation here now where if you're excessively stressed and your cortisol level is going up from stress, then it's also going to cause bile acids to dump into your gallbladder. And, of course, if you don't have a gallbladder, they're going to dump right into your digestive lining and burn the living daylights out of it. But even if you do have a gallbladder, you're likely to overfill it and then have what's called acid indigestion. So, how can you help this problem? Well, one thing would be to increase the fiber and friendly flora to help correct the imbalances in the small intestine. Maybe use some digestive enzymes. Of course, regular aerobics, as I mentioned earlier in the podcast here, regular aerobics will help not only your new blood cells, but it helps condition the fitness of your cortisol system, because you have to elevate your cortisol to perform aerobics. It actually creates a fitness in the system, so that's something. Stress management will help, because obviously if you're a little more calmer, you don't react so much to the stress, then your cortisol doesn't have to go up from stress so much, and then it's not going to have this additional side effect of dumping excess bile into your gallbladder. And then there's nutrients like the glucosterones, which will control the bile switches between the liver and the digestive tract. It's called farnesoid X receptor. But anyway, it helps, and that's why the glucosterones often will get rid of acid indigestion, because they're helping to get rid of bile acid indigestion. So there's things you can do here. And of course, acid-suppressing medication is quite dangerous when you use it over the long haul. I mean, I like to use the analogy that, you know, well, sometimes it's okay to put fire retardant on a forest fire. I mean, bad acid indigestion doesn't feel so good. Maybe there's some things you can do to prevent that, but, you know, I'm not saying never use an antacid for some people. But you don't manage the forest by using fire retardant. And if you're in that situation where you're on a regular use of an antacid, really of any kind, you've got a problem you're masking that's significant, and you need, it's a red flag staring you in the face. You need to get to the source of your actual problem, because this is the only way you're actually going to get your health back. Now, at least we understand a little bit more what's going on here. This actually makes a lot of sense to me. I hope I explained it clearly enough. Strokes on the rise in ages 15 to 34, this is rather amazing. I call it generation fat, for lack of a better word. I mean, we have all these young people now, type 2 diabetic, common in high school, junior high. I mean, this is unthinkable. I mean, what the heck is going on? This literally was unheard of 30 years ago. And it's all about parents who were overweight and then kind of program their kids to be fat, and then they give them the bad diets, and then they just get overweight, and then they don't, they're not active, and then they develop type 2 diabetes. I mean, by the time you develop type 2 diabetes, your metabolism is broken. I mean, we're talking about teenagers with broken metabolism who now are at risk for stroke, and in fact, this is happening in the age group 15 to 34. Utterly stunning. Utterly stunning. I mean, our society, which is becoming more and more an entitlement society, and you rest assured, I'm sure these people must think who are that you know they are entitled to health care for the rest of their life. Okay, I don't know how society can pay for all of this, quite frankly, especially when people do not seem to care too much about being responsible for their own health. I know most of you are and are taking steps in that direction, but we have a society that is not like that, you know, and you think to yourself sometimes, you go, well, gee, I wonder if we have these healthy people, then we'll reduce healthcare costs. No. That's not going to happen in the current political environment. I don't really want to go off into politics, but I just, you know, the comment is simply that you need the healthy people to pay for all the sick people, because the healthy people can still work unless they're healthy. And, you know, what are you supposed to do with all these sick people? Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm not insensitive to people with health problems. I'm just saying, you know, we got to have responsibility has to enter into this equation somewhere along the line. I mean, to think this is an entitlement right is beyond bizarre, especially because there's no way to pay for it. Really, there isn't. All right, back pain induces cognitive impairment. That's right, back pain induces cognitive impairment. This is a new study. And they're showing that people with chronic back pain actually have reduced gray matter volume in their brains, specifically affecting the core hypothalamus region of the subconscious brain, in turn inducing anxiety and depression along with impaired cognitive function from pain. Why? Because not only does it hurt wherever it's hurting, i.e. your back in this case, but that pain feeds back into your subconscious brain and sizzles it. It goes into the brain stem and then the subconscious core processing regions of pain, and it creates an inflammatory cascade that when that pain is ongoing, not only do you have the pain where you have the pain, physically speaking, but it feeds back into the brain and injures the brain and affects your brain. This is not good. Obviously, we need to get rid of pain. Obviously natural methods and actually getting through and over the inflammation and healing the tissues as best you can, which is possible in many, many situations, will help. Okay. Micro damage to the brain's blood vessels is associated with Parkinsonian symptoms. Now, this is really fascinating stuff, in my opinion. We have... basically this study shows that the current diagnostics cannot even identify a common problem during aging that is significantly reducing the physical function and quality of life in many people. So a lot of people have problems with what's called nerve muscle function, so they end up with shaky hands, a decline in walking speed, loss of balance, trouble with posture, and these Parkinsonian-like symptoms may never develop into full-blown Parkinson's. It's kind of like we have a sliding scale. And as it turns out, there is micro damage, microscopic blood vessel damage at the source of these symptoms in the brain. So the microscopic blood vessel damage is happening inside the brain's blood supply. The tiny ends of the capillaries are accumulating inflammatory damage from stress. Or possibly from chemical exposures, pollution, this kind of thing. I'm not defining the stress, but emotional stress would certainly count because adrenaline excess is toxic to the and inflammatory to the blood vessels. So here we see this. It's an accumulation of inflammatory damage in the end of little blood vessels in the brain that are actually causing a poor circulation to the nerves, in turn causing symptoms that look like Parkinson's. Now, you may be able to clean out such damage. Some bromelain might help clear it out. DHA, tocotrienols, grapeseed, resveratrol, blueberries, lipoic acid. I mean, there's a lot of things that are anti-inflammatory and can clean up some of these things that are possibilities for you. But I got to point out here, the doctors cannot even identify this. They don't have any tools right now to identify this. So you're not going to get, help from a neurologist understanding that you may or may not have this problem. The way these researchers figured it out was by doing autopsies on individuals and correlating the amount of neurologic symptoms they had to the type microscopic blood vessel damage, which they could see, under the microscope. That's why it's called microscopic blood vessel damage. But they could see it very clearly once you're not living anymore. So you can take this information and apply it while you are living, because it actually might help you. It goes to show that if you're developing neurologic symptoms that are sort of odd and unusual, shaky, jittery, whatever, I mean, maybe you should just evaluate the stressors in your life and figure out how to get them lower, which may mean, you have to solve some problems, or maybe it just means you need to look at things differently. I don't know. I mean, it's different things for different people. But I'm not trying to sit in judgment on what any one person must do. I'm just pointing out that this is the fact that you're going around feeling stressed day in and day out. There is accumulation of blood vessel damage from this, and that can result in neurologic symptoms that are Parkinsonian-like. And that's kind of interesting. Nobody's ever told anybody that before. And in kind of a related study, a lot of interesting studies this week, excessive and abnormal blood vessel formation linked to Alzheimer's. Okay, well, what's going on here is that you have a blood-brain barrier, which is supposed to have a certain structural and functional integrity. And so the difference in blood, I mean, what makes a blood-brain barrier is that the capillaries that are at the doorstep of your brain have fat wrapped around them, which is tight, so that things can't leak into your brain as easily, say, as they go around the rest of your body. So normally things in your bloodstream can permeate out into the tissues and then are picked back up again by your veins and brought back and recycled, and the liver and the kidneys clean these things, and we got all this process. We got a lot of stuff going around your body that you wouldn't want in your brain, is what it boils down to. The brain likes a very clean house. And so as you start to develop inflammation in your circulation in general, it starts to irritate those little capillaries that go into your blood-brain barrier, and it starts to expand them. It starts to compromise them. And now all of a sudden things start to leak into your brain that shouldn't be getting in there, and now your head doesn't feel as good. These things create interference with your brain's functionality and clarity. Your head feels cloudy, it feels foggy, it feels irritable, it feels poisoned. It just doesn't feel the way it should. It's not connecting, it's not in rhythm, it's not in sync. It's something isn't right. And, as this goes on over the years, the permeability, especially if you've been exposed to chemicals or toxins, or you have digestive imbalance and the toxins are getting into your bloodstream and then going across your blood-brain barrier, or inflammation coming from your fat is going past your blood-brain barrier, that's now been shown to happen. In other words, we got all these things that could get into your brain and start inducing damage to the structure of your brain, which can cause the formation of amyloid beta protein damage, which is, of course, eventually linked to cognitive decline in Alzheimer's. This new study is showing that as you start to develop this amyloid beta protein damage, tangly, goopy stuff, it's also happening at the site of your blood-brain barrier. And what does your body do in response to that? It starts to make new blood vessels to try to go around the problem, but it doesn't make them very well. It actually makes really leaky ones that actually let more crud into your brain and thus make the problem worse. Huh. This is not good at all. So, your body making new blood vessels in response to a problem. I mean, like this is the first I've ever heard of this happening at the level of the blood-brain barrier, but it's very interesting, especially with the last study I'm talking about with Parkinsonian-like symptoms from these kind of blood vessel damage. That they weren't talking about the blood-brain barrier in the Parkinsonian study. They were just talking about the blood vessels in the brain. It's all going on right in the same proximity. Amazing little study here. As I'm saying, not only does this happen in your brain, but let's say, the large artery coming out of your heart. When this happens, you start getting plaque, you start getting inflammation going there, and you start injuring the blood vessels. All of a sudden, you start making new... See, your artery actually has its own blood vessels inside the artery, nourishing the artery wall. And when that artery wall, the big thick artery coming out of your heart, starts to get injured, it starts to make new blood vessels that are abnormal and create a lot of inflammation and cause a lot of problems, actually. So we see when we start getting this abnormal blood vessel formation in response to a problem, we got problems with it. And it makes all the problems worse. In this case with the arteries, we get atrial fibrillation as a side effect of that and increased arterial plaquing in response. So, whatever starts out as the problem, if new blood vessel abnormal is the response to it, the original problem gets worse, and other problems follow. And this is how we get into some real issues. Anyway, this is now linked to Alzheimer's and cognitive decline. So the integrity of the blood-brain barrier, very, very, very important. Top nutrients, DHA, tocotrienols, grapeseed extract, resveratrol, panethine, acetyl L-carnitine. I mean, there's so many things that can be done here besides cleaning up your diet, cleaning up your digestive tract so that you have less irritants in your bloodstream in the first place. And, of course, managing stress falls into this category as well. We have a very clear picture here of how, I should say it's an emerging picture of some of the new ways in which inflammatory damage induces cascading events that send you down the wrong track and speed up cognitive decline. And, of course, I must tell you, if you haven't read, that the onset of cognitive decline and Alzheimer's disease is also trending way earlier in time now, so that people, we know, for example, that virtually every human being, by the time they're in their middle 30s, starts to develop amyloid beta protein injury in their nervous system. Everyone. Some small amounts, but this is a sliding scale. So it's like diabetes. You have perfect blood sugar on the one hand, diabetes on the other hand. And somewhere along that continuum, you'll find just about anybody. Most people aren't perfect, but and a lot of people aren't type 2 diabetic, but there's some shades of gray heading in the direction of wrong, or maybe going back in the direction of correct, depending on what they're doing. So it is with your brain and the accumulation of essentially gunky tangles in your brain that are not good for your brain. They get in the way of the speed and efficiency with which your brain wants to function. And so when people start developing this at age 35, and then it's just a question of, well, how much of it do you develop? And the trend right now, due to stress and poor diets and chemical exposures and all kinds of factors, is that now we're getting outright Alzheimer's in the 40s and becoming common in the 50s, not just in older people. And so this is a trend, like the type 2 diabetes trend, which has gotten down to teenagers, and the stroke trend, which is now getting lower. This cognitive decline trend is another one. And so this is a very good insight into some of, a key angle on it. I'm not saying this is the only thing going on with Alzheimer's, but it's certainly one area that is critical to using brain nutrition to support this, along with other things to manage stress and manage your lifestyle and exercise, which rejuvenates brain cells. Okay, well, that's it for the studies this week. Now we're going to turn to your questions. First one comes from Jennifer, who says, "Hi, I love your podcast and would like to know if what I read is true. I have candida and have been trying to get rid of it for a long time. I recently started taking MSM and taurine. I read that sulfur and taurine can feed and aggravate a gut dysbiosis / candida problem. What is your opinion on this?" Well, Jennifer, my opinion on this is that Candida albicans has a glutathione antioxidant defense system just like every cell in the human body. And glutathione antioxidant defense systems require sulfur molecules in order to function. So, you say, where do we go with this? If you take something with sulfur, which your body desperately needs, by the way, in order to function normally, could you also be feeding candida? Well, the answer is maybe. It's going to depend on the sulfur molecule, the sulfur compound, whether or not it's actually doing that if you take it. And more importantly, you get down to this question of, let's take this to the opposite side of the coin, which would be telling people not to consume anything with sulfur to reduce candida. It's like telling people to eat no carbohydrates to reduce candida. Who's going to starve first, the candida or you? Well, the answer is you. So if you want to go down this path, you could do the same thing with zinc. Candida likes zinc to survive. Your body loves zinc to survive. So you get to this issue, okay, where candida is living in weak body tissue. Sulfur is required not only for antioxidants, but as a pivotal molecule in making strong body tissue. So you have to have nutrients. Long story short, I'm not in favor of restricting any kind of sulfur intake for candida. I'm interested in killing candida along with restoring the health of your body tissue. Now, if you're taking anything with sulfur in it, which there's lots of things that have sulfur, lots of antioxidants, lipoic acid, I mean, there's a lot of antioxidants that have sulfur-related molecules in them, and you think you feel worse, or you actually do feel worse. I'm not saying to ignore that. Maybe you shouldn't take so much of that right now. But I'm definitely telling you these things are not bad for you. And you need to get to a point where you can use them. And so you need to combine, antifungal type things and also tissue reparative type things, that help your body get over this problem. And again, this is not an across the board thing. I mean, the sulfur molecules, say, of garlic, are very powerful antifungals. So, but, that's because that particular structure of the sulfur compound is directly interacting with the candida membrane and helping to kill it. And there are many things that help to kill candida. So you're always trying to find a combination of things that kill candida and nourish your body. Sulfur is critical for nourishing your body. If you want to keep it away from candida, then kill the candida while you're taking it, and that's that. That's why it works. That's what you should be doing. Great classes on Candida albicans, by the way, on the website in my free classroom for those of you interested in knowing more about Candida and how I think the problem should be addressed. Okay, oops, I don't know who asked me this question, sorry, but the question's about FemPlus. And the person said, is your FemPlus is the only product that I have come across that has 2 milligrams estriol and 20 milligrams of progesterone in one product. Is it okay to use this combination as one would use progesterone from day 14 until the onset of the menstrual cycle? Is estriol safe for 45 plus women, or is it absolutely essential to have testing? In Australia, there are a few doctors that really understand this area, and it's very expensive to get these tests, as well as having the ability to argue and prove to these doctors that one knows what they are doing as far as hormones. So if you could answer the best way to use this product and how, and any side effects. The best way to use the product, first of all, if you're in your mid-40s, you can certainly use the product to help with hot flashes or older than mid-40s. And it's fine if you're still having a menstrual cycle to use it as you would use the progesterone from day 14 until the onset of your menstrual cycle. It's also fine to use it every day, especially if your menstrual cycle's over, in small amounts. Estriol is very safe in general, and has anti-breast cancer, anti-female cancer properties. It actually dampens the signaling of estrogen, and so it's highly protective. Estriol is called the weak estrogen because it doesn't have anything to do with your menstrual cycle per se, but is protective and antioxidant and quite safe to use, and so it's a very good thing. If you need it, your ovaries make 2 milligrams of estriol every day for the rest of your life, even after menstruation, and estriol is a highly protective compound. Of course, if you don't have ovaries, you definitely need it because you can't really make up for it. And so the best subjective way of knowing that it's helpful is that it helps you to feel calmer, because if a woman is lacking estriol, she does not feel calm, and generally, no matter what else she does. And so estriol can be very helpful. Any side effects? With progesterone or estriol, and in this case they're in combination, if you're feeling any kind of side effect in terms of it's not doing what it's supposed to be doing to help your symptoms, or you actually feel that it's throwing your cycle out of balance or something funky about it, don't use it. Normally, you just stop using it and those things go away. Regardless of how helpful estriol or progesterone is, or is in theory, if it isn't actually doing something very helpful in actual practice, I would not use it. Now, I recommend invariably that we use the doses of these things in normal doses that our bodies would produce. That's why 2 milligrams of estriol and 20 milligrams of progesterone is within that. And you'll often find, compounding pharmacists giving much higher doses than that. I'm not in favor of that. I'm not in favor of forcing saliva or blood tests to look quote-unquote normal, or as if you are somehow biologically younger, because you're putting way more than normal amounts of hormones into your system, and that is a wild card of extreme risk, in my opinion. So I wouldn't do that. But as far as using this particular product in moderation, it's quite fine. Kind of a similar, well, not a similar question, but on the same topic, Danielle says, I'm 62 years old. Is it safe to continue taking bioidentical hormones indefinitely? I'm taking a cream with 2.25 milligrams estradiol and 2.5 milligrams a milliliter of testosterone. I take 0.5 milliliter morning and evening. I'm also taking 125 milligrams of progesterone in the evening before bed. How would I go about getting off them if it is not safe? Well, first of all, Danielle, you are taking hormones at abnormal levels of production. Your body never made those kind of hormones on its own. So this person who's giving you these is following this theory of trying to put your hormones into a lab test range. This doesn't take into account your health conditions, your inflammatory conditions, the health of the receptors of hormones, do they even function, and many other things in your body. And thus, the where those hormones might go or what they might do is a wild card variable. Estradiol, in my opinion, is not safe for anyone, although that doesn't mean that some people taking it may not have, you know, it might be okay for them. But, you know, estradiol is the form of estrogen, not the estriol, which is very, very safe. Estradiol is the one that can potentially cause cancer and heart disease when taken in excess. Testosterone for a woman is never a first choice in my book, and has all kinds of potential problems. It's a very, very big wild card. At your age, 62, it's not going to interfere with running menstrual cycles anymore, but it's still unpredictable in terms of which way it goes in metabolism, what it actually does. I just don't like testosterone for women, and I don't like 125 milligrams of progesterone. So I basically don't like what you're doing, and I'm not trying to scare you or anything. I'm just saying you're asking me what I think about it, and I'm telling you. Now, I've written two extremely in-depth articles on this, which you can find on my website at wellnessresources.com, Danielle, and one of them is called Oprah's Crazy Talk, Bioidentical Hormones, Helpful or Harmful, and then there's part one and part two. These are very thorough, in-depth articles that explain this subject in great depth. All referenced, all information is there, but anyone who's taking these higher levels of hormones or is considering doing it or is, you know, listening to Suzanne Summers or somebody else should read these articles because I personally don't think it's safe, which is the question you're asking. How do you get off it? Well, it depends on how you're feeling. I guess if you're feeling great, maybe it's not such a big deal. But a lot of women are taking these things, these hormones, to fix their symptoms, or so they think. And you've got a lot of things going on with hormones. You've got leptin, you've got stress factors, you've got inflammation, you've got many, many factors that you should be working on. So if you really get your quote-unquote house in order and you're still lacking hormones, maybe some isn't so bad. But when you're using hormones like estradiol and testosterone in particular to try to regulate symptoms at your age, it's not what your body ever does on its own. And it's not safe. Whether or not these hormones are bioidentical is irrelevant because they're being used in higher than normal physiologic doses. So if you're feeling crummy, you can mostly stop them. Well, you'll probably get some symptoms back, or you can wean off them. I mean, you can talk to whoever is helping you. If you call it help, I'm not very happy with the bioidentical hormone use in this country under the guise of natural medicine, because it really isn't natural and it really leaves a lot to be desired. Kay says, following the five rules of the leptin diet, I leave 5 hours between meals. Well, good for you, Kay. If I have a glass of water with fiber in between meals, is that considered snacking? No, I don't consider that snacking, Kay. Because there's just no calories in it. Yes, I know on the fiber it says there are carbohydrate calories, but that's because the FDA makes us put that on the label. But those carbohydrates are not digestibles, so it's irrelevant. So there's no surge in blood sugar in response to fiber. In fact, it may help you smooth out your blood sugar in between meals. And a lot of people like to take fiber in between meals because it helps them feel less hungry. You don't need to do that, but you can, and it certainly doesn't interfere with the rules of the leptin diet, especially if you feel good doing it. All right, Eva says, I've been diagnosed with diabetes type 2 2 years ago. Can you recommend for me any natural tablet to decrease my sugar level and allow me to lose weight? I also have high blood pressure. Well, it sounds kind of like you have metabolic syndrome, you know, with the type 2 diabetes, the high blood pressure, which essentially means, Eva, that your body is out of balance and your natural systems for bouncing back have been pushed out of alignment. And you have a project ahead of you. So there isn't just one pill that's going to help you. You have to have a combination of exercise, good diet, following the leptin diet, which is always the place to start. Leptin diet in and of itself will tend to reverse type 2 diabetes over a period of a year or two if you consistently follow it. I've seen this time and time and time again. So just following the five rules of the leptin diet will unravel the problem in most cases. Now, there are many, many nutrients you can use that help improve the efficiency of blood sugar metabolism. And in fact, I wrote an article, which is also on the website. It's called Insulin, Leptin, and Blood Sugar, Why Diabetic Medication Fails. It's a very thorough article. Not only does it explain why diabetic medication is basically pointless, I mean, yeah, you don't want your blood sugar skyrocketing to the point, I mean, that you have problems, but I'm not talking about type 1 diabetes, I'm talking about type 2 diabetes here. And you know, there are many nutrients you can use. I list about 15 different ones in this article and explain how they help. And you can plug in any one or other of them. I mean, I like things like cinnamon and chromium. And I mean, there's just so many of them. So to answer your question, there's a lot you can do. But it isn't simply just taking a nutrient. You've got to get a whole program working for you, and you've got to get a system that doesn't process sugar anymore and has developed insulin resistance of multiple types back functioning again. So there's no quick fix, but there is a fix, and that's what's encouraging. Now, if you're trying to find articles on the website, like, if you want to find this one, Eva, you just go to the website, you go to the search engine on our website, and you type in something like what's in the title, insulin, leptin, and blood sugar, and you'll see the article pop up. You can also search Google similarly. You can just go to the Google search engine or any search engine, and you type in insulin, leptin, and blood sugar, and then in parentheses you type in wellness resources, which is my company, and Google will search our website for you. So you can either use our search engine or some other search engine, just type in our company name, and you'll find my articles on any topic. So if you want to, you know, listen to Oprah's Crazy Talk, Bioidentical Hormones, you just sort of type that in the search engine, and it will come up with it for you. It's amazing how these search engines work these days. Christine says, a few months ago we traveled to Africa, Tanzania, and Ethiopia. In preparation for this trip, we decided to get our 13-year-old daughter vaccinated. She has not been vaccinated up until this point. From January to June of this year, we gave her TD, polio, hep A, and yellow fever. About a month after our trip, we had a visit at Disneyland where we stayed all day. The following morning, our daughter had a grand mal seizure. She is scheduled to see a neurologist in November as a follow-up to her one and only seizure. Her general health is relatively good. However, she is lactose intolerant and has a sour stomach from time to time. What nutritional support would you recommend for her? In your opinion, could the immunizations have been a factor in her seizures? Well, yes, of course. You know, immunizations contain adjuvants, which are neurotoxic on purpose. And a neurotoxic adjuvant is designed to provoke an inflammatory response along with the attenuated or weakened pathogen, so that the weakened pathogen actually produces an immune response. So by combining the deadened pathogen with an inflammatory, neurotoxic inflammatory adjuvant, you induce, in theory, an immune response as opposed to just, you know, trying to immunize someone with a live, active infection, which has obvious risks. So the trade-off here, then, for immunization theory is that you're on purpose inflaming the nervous system, intentionally. Now, what happens in any one person could be very all over the place in response to this. In other words, not everyone's going to have a textbook response, and that's the problem. So you're going to have people with varying degrees of inflammation in their nervous systems already, and then you add in this new wild card variable, and then who knows how that trains the nervous system to behave. Could that cause a seizure? Well, of course it could, and of course seizures are one of the side effects for vaccinations, although the doctor will always tell you that no. But it's not true. So you ask me, in my opinion, could the immunizations have been a factor in her seizure? The answer is, well, possibly. We don't know that for a fact, but possibly. Is Disneyland a factor? I don't know. I say that sort of half jokingly. I mean, Disneyland would have a lot of neurologic stimulation, excessively so, you know, and maybe a lot of disorientation of rides. I mean, I don't know. Maybe that would do it. I guess that would be possible. You know, it's possible. I've never seen a study on it. But, you know, and then we've got this sour stomach. Well, there you've got maybe more than, you know, if the stomach flares up from eating poorly, going to Disney World, eating a bunch of junk food, you could have a flare-up of neurotoxic stuff coming from the digestive tract, crossing the blood-brain barrier and irritating the nervous system. And that could have been going on for years anyway, and then you add the toxic adjuvant to that from the vaccinations, and the additional effect of the vaccination in conjunction with a pre-existing inflammatory situation. I mean, just because the inflammation is going on in the digestive tract does not mean it isn't also irritating the brain. You've got a young person here who knows what stress she's under. 13-year-olds tend to be under varying types of peer pressure and social pressure and you know, pressures that a 13-year-old young lady would have, and this is typical also. So you've got a combination of potential stress factors, digestive factors, immunization factors, traveling factors, ride factors at Disneyland. I mean, you got all these things going on. And so it's hard, you know, no one's ever going to say it's just the immunizations or it's just this or that. But it's probably a collection of those things. So you do what you can to work on the symptoms. The fact that she's only had one seizure, that's a good thing. But you do want to, you know, work with stress. You do want to work with clearing out inflammation in the brain. I like nutrients like Daily Balancer, Brain Protector. These are good things in general, and help to reduce inflammation in the brain. And then, the only real symptoms you've given me that she has would be working on improving digestive health, maybe some acidophilus. Just maybe cleaning up, reducing the sugar in the diet, that kind of thing. And then, you know, discussing stress, seeing where she's at with that. That would be maybe a contributing factor. Hopefully this is just a one-time thing. A lot of times it is. So it's, but the problem, of course, is once the body has done something, it can do it again. And so you want to try to minimize the inflammatory effects. Hopefully the immunizations and the inflammation effect from them would be transient in nature and not a learned ongoing lesson, which would then create repetitive seizures. So, but it sounds that it may just be kind of a one-time thing, and that would be good. It is possible that the adjuvant effect, the neurologically inflammatory effect from vaccines could be transient and not permanent in nature. So hopefully those things will work in her favor for you, Christine. Okay, well, that's it for your questions this week. If you have a question for me, please email it to me, askbyron@wellnessresources.com. And, of course, I will be back next week with yet another weekly Wellness Update podcast. Thanks again for tuning in, and have a healthy week.
The Weekly Wellness Update podcast is produced by Wellness Resources Incorporated, copyright 2008, all rights reserved. For more information on the topics and news covered in today's podcast, visit wellnessresources.com. To email Byron a specific health question, send it to askbyron@wellnessresources.com. The information presented in this podcast is for informational purposes. It is not medical advice for the treatment of any condition or illness. You should not use the information in this podcast for diagnosis or treatment of any health problem or to discontinue the use of any medication that has been prescribed to you. Consult your physician or healthcare professional for such needs. Statements made during this podcast regarding any Wellness Resources dietary supplement products have not been evaluated by the FDA. Wellness Resources dietary supplement products are not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.